This is John Williams reaching out to our old friend, President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson, can you hear me? Welcome.
Good day to you, my dear citizen.
Last time we spoke, President Jefferson, you were telling us that the garden is still going well in Monticello. I presume that things are all well where you are?
Yes, it's another great year. We're going to have a spectacular crop in my garden. I grow 29 varieties of vegetable peas.
Rather than dwell on that, if you don't mind, as we speak, it is Mother's Day weekend. I have not asked you about your mom before. We certainly spoke about your late wife. Of course, you're kind of late, too, now that I think about it. But what would you say to us on Mother's Day, sir?
Well, my mother, Jane Randolph, came from the Randolph family, which traced its genealogy well back into British aristocracy, to which I let every listener determine what value they want to give that. But she was one of the two or three most prominent families in Virginia. The Randolphs were wealthy, prolific, eccentric, and she married my father, who was really just from the overseer class, Peter Jefferson. So he, in a sense, he married up. He married into this very important clan. And my mother was a strong woman, a brilliant letter writer, but we were not particularly close. And in fact, she died in the spring of the year that I wrote the Declaration of Independence, and I had a migraine headache. I called it my periodical headache, but I almost never mentioned her for the rest of my life. And historians have determined from that I must have had some disenchantment with her, or that I didn't love her, and that's not true at all. But I adored my father, and I looked to him as a sort of model for my adult behavior. And my mother, although an extraordinary woman, was not someone that I felt that I wanted to write about to posterity.
I wonder what a good Mother's Day gift would be. I wonder what Thomas Jefferson, the son, would give his mother. You know, Mother's Day wasn't an invention, I don't think, in your era, but I'm telling you what, that's a big deal in ours.
Well, I might bring her a bouquet of wildflowers from the hillside at Monticello. I might bring her over a side of pork or a turkey. You know, but we were farmers. We were basic Americans who had to provide our own food. And we were involved in the slaughter of animals and the growing of crops and the brewing of beer and cider. And so I probably would have brought her foodstuffs or something that would be good for a Mother's Day meal.
You didn't have cologne back then?
There was cologne.
You should have got her a bottle of cologne. Moms are nuts for that stuff. Wives love that, this sort of thing.
You know, it was called civet during the Elizabethan era, and it came from the glands of cats. So I think perfume has become more chemically pure in your time. We had it, and of course we needed it. We also took snuff, John, because people didn't bathe in my era, and because of that there was a great deal of body odor, and to overcome that we would have little tins of snuff, which was kind of a perfumed powder, and we would pull a little of that into our nose. And then it would serve as a sort of a perfumed filter against the intense odors of human beings around us.
I've seen people do that, you know, like in movies that depict your era. And I understand how that works. Another way to fight that would have been y'all should have just been taking some baths. Why did just get some water and splash around, get some soap and clean yourself. You know, even in this day and age, there's some folks that carry a more body odor than they have to. I don't understand that, Mr. Jefferson.
Well, we actually believed that it was not too healthy to bathe too often because it would remove essential body oils that were important to maintain our health systems and skin quality. And so the average American in my time would have taken 3 or 4 or 5 baths per year. I was more likely to cleanse myself than the average person, but I'll tell you this, if you went into a tavern in Williamsburg or Philadelphia, the smell would overpower you in your time. But we were used to it, and so the snuff was not a narcotic. It had no medicinal effect. It was really just a fad that allowed a slight perfume filter between us and the outside world. I know you've changed your social habits, and believe me, I had a toothbrush and cleaned my teeth and brushed my hair and I was on the elegant side of the 18th century.
Man, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. There will be another day for us to talk a little bit more about it. But I know that you were very, very close to your wife, if not your mother. And we tend to think of the women in our lives on Mother's Day. Can you just tell me a minute or two about the relationship you and your children had with your wife?
Well, I met her when I was a young man, and she was a widow. She had been married to a college classmate of mine, Bathurst Skelton, and he had died, and she now had moved back to the forest, her father's plantation. I courted her there, and she was an extraordinary woman, beautiful, diminutive. She had that softness of disposition, which I like in women, and Virginians like in women. Highly cultivated, a good cook and manager of the farm estates. But we actually fell in love over music, and I was one of a bunch of courters who were in the parlor, and we were each called in turn to spend a little time with her. And the others who were waiting to follow me heard us singing a duet, me on the fiddle and she on the pianoforte, and they sensed from the quality of harmony in our voices that this was more than a song. And they all picked up their hats and left. And then we had 10 years of what I would call uncheckered happiness. She was an extraordinary wife, gave birth to six children during the course of our 10 years, and unfortunately died of complications from birthing her sixth child in the autumn of 1782. So she died at the age of 33. I had what you would call a nervous breakdown over it, but she was the best of women, the best of mothers, and the best of friends.
You had to audition for the part, huh?
Had to audition for the part. It was by no means clear that I would win this part because although I was a scholar and an intellectual and a ranch farmer, plantation owner of some importance, there were many wealthier men who wanted her hand. And if you've ever read a Jane Austen novel, you know that in my era, people didn't marry for love as much as they married for property and for economic advantage. And so it was fortunate that I was a pretty good fiddler. I was able to convince her to marry me, but I was very concerned that she might find richer, more comfortable quarters.
There's a new book out I want to talk to you about in just a minute, but I don't want to let the end of our conversation trail off with us trying to put together a good campaign slogan for you were you to run in the next presidential election. So can I just ask you a little bit about that now?
Yes, of course.
Last we spoke, you liked the campaign slogan, Happiness, Liberty, Agriculture, and Learn to Read Greek, correct?
Well, I think I said it a little more elegantly, happiness, liberty, and ancient Greek in the original. But yes, of course, we should all read Greek. That's, I think, the number one language for lovers of liberty.
Right. And you threw in agriculture too. Are you willing to excise that? Can we drop the agriculture from your campaign slogan?
Well, I said that those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God. Maybe we should call it chosen people of God.
Oh, really? How about that? Now you're a Republican. Do you want to go with that? Because here's what I have for you. Jefferson then, Jefferson now, exclamation point. I've been thinking about that. You know, I mean, we love Thomas Jefferson. We love the founding fathers. We love all that you've. We're still standing 200 years later on your shoulders. So Jefferson then, Jefferson now, we get rid of the Greek and the agriculture stuff.
Well, I would, of course, be heartbroken to leave agriculture and Greek behind. But let me suggest this. If it's Jefferson then, Jefferson now, with a comma in the middle,
Right.
there should be a question mark at the end. Because as you know, I'm not a man of ambition. I want to leave to the people the determination if they think that I am the least bad candidate.
No, that's a deal breaker. You can't say, hey, what do y'all think? Should I be president? That's not how you. You
I
don't
regarded
campaign.
the presidency like jury duty. I didn't want to be president. I wanted the people to decide what was in their best interest.
I would, not only should there be an exclamation point, there shouldn't be a question mark. I think the best I could meet you would be Jefferson then, comma, Jefferson now, period. Maybe now in bold letters, like, you know, right now, Jefferson now. What do you think of that?
I would prefer to keep lower case. You know, I didn't even capitalize the first letter in my sentences. I had a very idiosyncratic prose style and a set of personal conventions and personal spellings. But if you say Jefferson then,
right,
comma or dash, Jefferson now, I think a full stop, a period, that allows the voter to determine whether this is a question, a proposition, or a command.
It should, well, I want you to, on the stump, say it more as a command. I mean, let's face it, nobody wants a tentative leader, so you need to sort of grab the bull by the horns and say, I want to lead you. I believe I'm the best possible person. I can get the job done. Jefferson, now.
Repeat after me. Let me give you Hamilton's cell number. You're talking about Hamilton here, or Aaron Burr, or Patrick Henry. I mean, you say nobody wants that, but the people of the United States actually wanted me twice in 1800 and again in 1804, and I would have been reelected to a third and a fourth term. So I think you may be living in a decadent age, John. In my time, being reluctant and shy was actually an advantage for a political figure.
Hillary's not reluctant and shy. None of the Republicans are reluctant and shy. Joe Biden's not
reluctant.
Hamilton
will take your call, and he will use 6 exclamation points.
There's a book out called The Jefferson Rule, How the Founding Fathers Became Infallible and Our Politics Inflexible. This is the last thing I want to talk to you about today, President Jefferson, and that is the notion that you guys got it right. We shouldn't mess with what you all laid out for us. What's your reaction to that?
Well, first of all, I would say that it should not be called the Jefferson Rule. I had limited influence over my era and over our interpretations of the Constitution, and I wasn't even one of the authors of the United States Constitution. But I take your point that the Founding Fathers were highly intelligent people who had studied the past, you know, the Greek leagues and ancient Athens and the Roman Republic and so on. And we really put down a beautiful basic template for those who wish to pursue liberty with a Bill of Rights, checks and balances, and so on. But I, as you I'm sure know, advocate tearing up the Constitution once every generation. I believe that your era is certainly as thoughtful as ours, and that if you gathered together 55 men from around the colonies, you could produce an extraordinary constitution that would meet your needs and your dreams and your technologies and your demographics.
I think that's a really bad idea. I think that, can you just imagine how contentious and how unproductive a constitutional convention would be today that tried to figure out what language to say about gay rights or about gun control or about when life begins? I can just... We would never produce a document. Nothing would get done.
My friend, I think that you're going to find me to be a very annoying candidate, because all of your instincts are those that seem to be at odds with my basic set of principles. And I don't want to be frustrating to you if we move forward in this way. It seems that you really are pretty certain that if you followed my approach to a campaign, but not only would I lose, but lose in a kind of appalling and humiliating way.
Well, if you want to go back to the campaign slogan, yeah, we gotta tighten that thing up, and you do need to, you know, express yourself, what your platform is. But back to the constitutional convention, say,
right.
You think we should tear up the Constitution every X number of
years, or once per generation? So. Whenever half of the current majority, whenever half of the population of the United States is dead, that majority, that generation should be said to be gone, and then
okay.
The new generation creates its own document.
Okay, so today we would do it about every 50 years, but that means
right.
That then for maybe twice in my lifetime, I would see rights given to gays or gun laws being very liberal, and then I would see a constitution which could be very opposite that. That's the political tide that you have sometimes. You're okay
well,
with
course.
That?
Of course. Yes, because I believe the earth belongs to the living, who are the actual sovereign, and that they're entitled to adjust the world according to their own needs and their own concerns and their own dreams. But just take gay marriage, for example, which I blush that we would even talk about in this way. But if you don't do this in terms of your constitution, then it will be done instead by the courts. And then when the courts to try to make sense of what the Constitution's implications might be for this, then you'll accuse those justices of legislating from the bench. In other words, if you don't actually gather together and determine how you want to respond to these critical situations, then you force judicial interpretation instead, and that gives far, far too much power to men who have never been elected to anything.
Yeah, I understand that, but I just thought there were some truths that were self-evident, that all men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that the Constitution sort of anticipated that, or the Declaration did. It said, look, here's just the basic nuts and bolts that you ought to live by. And I can see a Constitution today getting way too specific and too controlling.
Well, it is right that the best constitutions are so simple. Solon did one for Athens, for example, and it was so simple in the 6th century B.C. that all of it could be written out on a placard and displayed in the agora, in the public forum. That's what you want, something so simple that the merest farmer or merchant or homemaker could understand it in its entirety. When you create a Byzantine structure of hundreds and thousands of laws, nobody can understand them, and nobody can honestly say that they have accepted that code.
That's the IRS today. All right, so let's wrap it up with this, President Jefferson. Jefferson then, Jefferson now, now in bold letters, period. I'm going to sit on that for a week, if you don't mind.
I think Jefferson then, certainly, now perhaps.
Jefferson then, now perhaps? No,
yes.
that's...
Don't you think?
No. I'll talk to you about this next week, sir. Well, thank you for your time.
You know, everything takes four or five drafts, even the Declaration of Independence. Let's keep talking.